Well, I mentioned last time that we would finish up Matthew, but I decided to not do that this week, just because if I did part of Matthew this time and then I do part of Mark, then everything gets all split up and messed up. So why don't we just start with Mark today, and hopefully when we get back to Matthew, we'll try to maybe pick up where we left off earlier. Turn with me to the Gospel of Mark. And like last week, we'll kind of go fast at certain places. But let's look at a few details about this gospel. First of all, like we did last time, let's look at the author. The author of this Gospel of Mark has, from the earliest times, been attributed to this man, Mark. But the gospel itself is anonymous. It doesn't say, Mark writes this. Early tradition going back to about 140 is that Mark was the author and that he received most of his information from Peter. And so we have this man, Mark, who's mentioned in the book of Acts a number of times, but also he has a connection with Peter, and we'll see later with Paul. And so that gives him a measure of authority. You may remember a man named Eusebius. He wrote around the time of the Council of Nicaea. He wrote a church history up to that time. Remember, the Council of Nicaea was what year? What's the first number in the year? Which century? It was 325. And so this was after less than three centuries of church history. Eusebius wrote his own church history. And it's through him that we know a lot of the things that happened in that time, because the materials that Eusebius used are, in many cases, lost to us. But because Eusebius copied them, we have some record of what these people said. And Eusebius quotes Papias. Now, Eusebius wrote about 320, and he's quoting Papias, who lived in the early 100s, and even before that, and he may have known the Apostle John. So this is an early attestation to this. And this is what Eusebius, quoting Papias, says. This also the presbyter, and this may have been the Apostle John himself. So Papias quoting the Apostle John. Mark, having become the interpreter of Peter, wrote down accurately, though not in order, whatever he remembered of the things said or done by Christ. For he neither heard the Lord nor followed him, but afterward, as I said, he followed Peter, who adapted his teaching to the needs of his hearers, but with no intention of giving a connected account of the Lord's discourses, so that Mark committed no error while he thus wrote some things as he remembered them. For he was careful of one thing, not to omit any of the things which he had heard, and not to state any of them falsely. So we have here a message, again, possibly from the Apostle John himself, but certainly early in the 100s from Papias, that Mark was an interpreter of Peter. So Peter had these stories about Christ, and Mark knew them and wrote them down. And he also wrote them down, as Papias believed, without error. We also have Eusebius quoting, or at least mentioning, Clement of Alexandria. And Clement of Alexandria lived in the late 2nd century, so again, very early. He says this, the gospel, according to Mark, had this occasion. As Peter had preached the word publicly at Rome and declared the gospel by the Spirit, many who were present requested that Mark, who had followed him for a long time and remembered his sayings, should write them out. And having composed the gospel, he gave it to those who had requested it. When Peter learned of this, he neither directly forbade nor encouraged it. So according to Clement of Alexandria, Peter was aware of what Mark had done. Now, Irenaeus, we may remember him from early on as well in our heresies. He wasn't a heretic. He spoke against heresies. And he said this, around 180. Matthew also issued a written gospel among the Hebrews in their own dialect while Peter and Paul were preaching at Rome and laying the foundations of the church. After their departure, that means after their death, Mark, the disciple and interpreter of Peter, did also hand down to us in writing what had been preached by Peter. Now, these views of these men are not infallible. In fact, you'll notice that Irenaeus says that Mark wrote after the death of Peter and Paul, after their departure, where Clement of Alexandria said that Peter was around when Mark wrote his gospel. We don't know exactly when Mark wrote his gospel, but it was probably around the time of Peter's death, in the 60s, maybe a little earlier than that. But it does show, these quotes show, the early attribution of this gospel to this man, Mark, and also Mark's connection with Peter. Now, who is John Mark? We learn about John Mark in the book of Acts. Let's look at Acts chapter 12. We'll go through this fairly quickly. Acts 12. Remember, Peter was in prison and he was led out by an angel. Remember, Peter goes to this house and knocks on the door, and the servant girl can't believe it's Peter. They think it's his ghost. We see here, when he, that is Peter, knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Oops, I missed a verse here. Verse 12. When he realized this, this is Peter again, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, while many were gathered together and were praying. So, John, Mark, had a mother named Mary, and it was at this house that the early church was praying for Peter. Look at verse 25 in the same chapter. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had fulfilled their mission, taking along with them John, who was also called Mark. So when Barnabas and Saul went to Jerusalem, remember Mark, John Mark lived there, they decided to take John Mark with them on their journey. Next chapter, chapter 13, verse 5. When they reached Salamis, they began to proclaim the word of God in the synagogues of the Jews, and they also had John as their helper. Verse 13. So John's helping them, John Mark. Now Paul and his companions put out to sea from Paphos and came to Perga in Pamphylia, but John left them and returned to Jerusalem. We don't know why, but for some reason John Mark decided that he needed to get back home. And this caused problems later. Let's turn over to Acts 15. John Mark appears again. Acts 15, verses 36 to 39. Now remember, in all these travels, Barnabas was Paul's constant companion. After some day, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let us return and visit the brethren in every city which we proclaim the word of the Lord, and see how they are." Barnabas wanted to take John, called Mark, along with them also, but Paul kept insisting that they should not take him along, who had deserted them in Pamphylia and had not gone on with them to the work. And there occurred such a sharp disagreement that they separated from one another, and Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus. So Paul thought that John Mark was not reliable because he had left them early on in the first missionary journey. And so Paul said, you know what, let's just not use him right now. But Barnabas wanted to have John Mark ministering with them. And while this is sad to see the split between Paul and Barnabas in God's providence, what happened then? Did Barnabas and Mark just stay home and watch SportsCenter? No, they went out and ministered themselves. So this split, though it was sad, ended up meaning that there were now two missionary teams, and so God in his providence doubled the effectiveness due to this split over John Mark. And John Mark was still with Barnabas. Now let's look into some of these letters. We wonder, did Paul and Mark ever reconcile? What happened with that? Well, look at Colossians chapter 4. Colossians chapter 4, verse 10. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, sends you his greetings, and also Barnabas' cousin Mark, about whom you received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. So now we see perhaps a little bit of why Barnabas was so inclined to have Mark with them, is because Mark was one of his relatives. And so he was especially dear to Barnabas. And now, later on in Paul's life, Paul is now in prison in Rome, and Mark is sending greetings. So Mark, we can tell, at this point is in Rome. Mark is with Paul, or in the area. He visits Paul from time to time, at least. And so Mark sends greetings to the church in Colossae. Look also at Philemon. You remember that Philemon was written to Philemon, who was a member of the Colossian church. So Philemon and Colossians were written at the same time. They were carried. So when Paul wrote to Colossae, he also had a personal letter to Philemon. They would have gone together to this church in Colossae. And look at verse 24. Paul here mentions that Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, and Luke, and so forth, send greetings to Philemon. So Mark, again, is in Rome with Paul at this point. Look at 2 Timothy, one more verse regarding the relationship between Paul and Mark. 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 11. Only Luke is with me. Now remember, this is at the end of Paul's life. He knows that he's about to die. He's in prison for the second time in Rome. Only Luke is with me. Pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service. So Mark now is in Ephesus with Timothy. Paul wants Timothy to come visit Paul, but bring Mark with you because Mark is useful to me for service. So this young man who was at one point, Paul thought, to use a modern term, a little flaky. Paul thought Mark was flaky. He didn't want them with him on a trip. But now later in Paul's life, Mark is useful to him for service. So this is a good lesson to us, both from Paul's side to, if somebody disappoints you, somebody is unfaithful in ministry, to not set them aside and make them useless, but to keep working with them so that they can become useful to you. But on the John Mark side, one failure in ministry doesn't mean that you are forever sidelined necessarily from doing what needs to be done, and that you can overcome those things and become useful again to the Lord for ministry. Now let's look at 1 Peter now. 1 Peter, real quickly. We've seen from the early church fathers that there was a connection between Mark and Peter. Well, we see that in the first epistle of Peter. Look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13. 1 Peter 5, 13. Peter writes here, "She who is in Babylon, chosen together with you, sends you greetings, as does my son Mark." Now Peter, Mark isn't really his actual, literal, biological son, but he was so dear to Peter that Peter calls him his son. So he is a special person, a special young man in the eyes of Peter here. And Peter here, I believe, is writing from Rome, and so Mark is with him there in Rome. Now, one last little... Yes? Can't be absolutely 100% sure, but just because of the way that Luke refers to him throughout the book of Acts, and we see these names pop up, you expect it's the same young man. Yeah, it's not 100% sure, but it's likely. There are other names like that. You see them in Acts, you see them in Paul's letters. Are they the same person? You can't always be 100% sure, especially if it's a real common name, but that's just our inference, and it's been taught that for many, many years, since early years. You look at early commentaries about Mark and references to Mark, it's associated with the same person. Let's look at Mark 14, the gospel itself. Now, we've said that the gospel of Mark is anonymous. We don't know from the text itself who wrote the gospel, but we get an interesting little story here that may actually be what we would call a cameo appearance of Mark, although anonymous in this gospel. This is after Jesus has been arrested in the garden. And look at verse 51 of Mark 14. This is after the disciples have left Jesus and fled. "A young man was following him," that is Jesus, "wearing nothing but a linen sheet over his naked body, and they seized him. But he pulled free of the linen sheet and escaped naked." Now, this is a very strange little paragraph here. Who is this young man? It doesn't say who it is. It's also interesting that in the parallel passages in Matthew and Luke and even John, there's no mention of this young man. Why is it that Mark mentions this? And the conclusion that most people have come to is that this is Mark himself. Remember, Mark lived in Jerusalem, right? We see that in Acts 12. At least later on, he lived in Jerusalem. His mother had a house there. It was large enough to contain many Christians. And so Mark may have lived in Jerusalem at this time and been something of a follower of Jesus. And when all this stuff was going on, he was in the area, but he just had this sheet around himself. And as he was noticed and grabbed on the sheet, he ran away. There are only, according to one count, 5 stories in Mark, not in the other Gospels. Remember, we have these parallel passages. Mark only has about 5 stories or bits of stories in his Gospel. There are no other Gospels, and this is one of them. And so this is a good indication that Mark is, in an anonymous way, inserting himself into the story here. And so he may well have been at least an eyewitness of certain parts of Jesus' ministry. Again, we can't say for sure, but it's an interesting idea. Yes, Josh?
I'm just curious, have you read anything why the book of Mark was anonymous? I mean, is there a reason why they would, the author
Well, it wasn't anonymous to the original people who got it, right? And that's part, it wasn't necessarily common to say, this is written by so-and-so. The people who got the Gospel of Mark knew who it was, because he wrote it for them. Mark, again, assuming this is all historically correct, and we'll look at this in a moment, who is he writing to? Mark wrote down this gospel, and he said, here you go, church at Rome, I believe. Here's what Peter has told me, maybe some eyewitness things of myself, of what Jesus said and did. And so to them, it wasn't anonymous. Same thing with Matthew. The people who received Matthew first knew that Matthew wrote it, or Luke or John. And so it wasn't really a common thing to put your name on it necessarily. Now, letters are a different thing, because you're writing a letter from person A to person B, you say person A to person B. But these gospels, these sort of biographies, would not necessarily have had that same name given to them. All right, let's look now at the readership. The readership. Who is Mark writing to? And we've seen this link to Rome. When Paul is in Rome, Mark is with him. When Peter's in Rome, Mark is with him. And there's some good internal evidence in the gospel itself that he's writing to primarily Roman or Gentile readers, these readers in Rome itself, in this church. Now, why do we say that? First of all, Mark explains Jewish customs. Now, if you were writing to Jews in Judea or near Judea, you wouldn't need to explain Jewish customs because you would already know them, wouldn't you? But let's listen to Mark chapter 7, verses 2 to 4. He's speaking about Pharisees and some scribes. They had seen that some of Jesus' disciples were eating their bread with impure hands, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they carefully wash their hands, thus observing the traditions of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they cleanse themselves. And there are many other things which they have received in order to observe, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and copper pots. These verses 3 and 4, this sort of parenthesis, is not in the Gospel of Matthew, when Matthew tells the same story, because Matthew was, we believe, writing largely to Jews. So the Jews knew these regulations. But for Mark writing to Gentiles, they would have needed to know this information because it wouldn't have been familiar to them. Also, let's look at Mark chapter 15. Mark 15, verse 42. When evening had already come, because it was a preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath, Joseph of Arimathea came. So we have this explanation that this preparation day was the day before the Sabbath. Again, that a Jew would have already known that, but for a Gentile, he wouldn't have known the distinction necessarily between preparation days and Sabbaths, and not very much about things like the Passover and so forth. We also see that Mark, while he uses Aramaic words a lot, he explains them, he translates them for the people who were reading. Remember, Aramaic was a very common language in the area of Syria, Judea, the part where the Jews lived. But in Rome, Aramaic would have been probably very little known to most people. But when you see in Mark 5:41, I'll just read this to you. When Jesus is raising this little girl from the dead, he takes the child by the hand and he said to her, Talitha cum, which translated means, little girl, I say to you, get up. So Matthew, if you had spoken to his audience, Talitha cum, they would have recognized that means, little girl, I say to you, get up. But for a Roman, a Gentile who knew Greek and Latin, they probably would not have been familiar with Aramaic. Also, it's interesting that Mark uses more Latin loan words. You know, we have loan words from French and some German and other kinds of things. We borrow words from other languages. Well, the ancients did that as well. And so the Greeks would find a Latin term that was useful, so they would use that or that sort of thing. And so, for example, when Matthew and Luke refer to a centurion, they use a Greek word that means ruler of 100. A centurion is what? A soldier who's in charge of 100 other soldiers. And so Matthew and Luke use the Greek word that means ruler of 100, but Mark uses the Latin word transliterated into Greek. Does that make sense? So Mark takes a Latin word, which is like centurion. Centuria is a Latin kind of Latin-based word. He takes that Latin word, converts it into Greek, and then uses that in the Greek, whereas Matthew and Luke just use the direct Greek word. Does that make sense? So Mark sometimes takes Latin words and puts them into Greek for the benefit of his Roman audience, presumably. Also in Mark 12:42, when Jesus is talking about the woman who puts those two small copper coins into the treasury, when Mark tells that story, he says these two lepta means really small, a very small thing, these two small coins, which amount to a quadrans, which is a Roman coin. So if you were, let's say, writing a story about somebody who lived in Germany, but you're writing it for an American audience, you might say, so-and-so spent 10 Deutschmarks on something, which amounts to however many dollars it is. Does that make sense? So you would translate things like measures, weights, coinage from the place where it happened to your local measurement so it would make sense to people. So Mark does those sorts of things, whereas the other gospel writers don't do that, typically. Another interesting feature of his gospel is that he mentions a man named Rufus in Mark 15:21. Let me just read this to you. Remember, Jesus is going to be crucified, and they pressed into service a passerby coming from the country, Simon of Cyrene. Now, Matthew and Luke also mention Simon of Cyrene, but Mark gives them a new detail. He says that Simon of Cyrene is the father of Alexander and Rufus. And so this Simon bears his cross. He's the father of Alexander and Rufus. Now, why would Mark mention Alexander and Rufus, whereas the other gospel writers don't mention Alexander and Rufus? The only conclusion we can really come to is that the people who received Mark's gospel knew who Alexander and Rufus were, whereas Matthew and Luke's readers did not know who Alexander and Rufus were. When you look at Romans 6:13, you see something interesting. Paul here is writing to the church at Rome, of course, and Paul says, "Greet Rufus, a choice man in the Lord, also his mother and mine." So this man Rufus was a man in the Roman church that Paul knew. And again, you can't say 100% for sure, but we see this name Rufus appearing in Mark, the Gospel of Mark, as the son of Simon of Cyrene. And then we also see him in the church at Rome when Paul writes. So very likely this man Rufus was part of the church in Rome, well known to the recipients of the Gospel of Mark. So just one more detail that indicates that Mark was writing to the church at Rome, and particularly these Gentile readers in that church. Now, let's go to some themes of the Gospel of Mark. Yeah, we'll go through this fairly quickly. We see from the very first verse, Mark tells us what he's doing. Really abrupt entrance into the Gospel of Mark. He says that this book is the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. And you might call that his thesis. Remember when you write a story in school, you have to have a thesis statement, and you have to prove your thesis. And here, Mark is stating his thesis, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He's going to tell us this good news, the gospel. This man, Jesus, who lived in Palestine in this time, is the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One. He is also the Son of God. And so we have this theme that Jesus is the Messiah. We have this theme that Jesus is the Son of God. And of course, that all this information, all this life of Jesus was the good news. We see Jesus as the Son of God in many places. Let me just sort of skip through these quickly. We looked at these some last week when we looked at Matthew. Remember, Matthew and Mark and Luke have a lot of parallel passages, but just listen. When Jesus is baptized, the Father says, "You are my beloved Son, and you I am well pleased." So we have the Father saying that Jesus is his Son. In Mark chapter 3, we see the unclean spirits coming out of people, and as they come out, they say, "You are the Son of God," and Jesus tells them to be quiet. He doesn't need publicity from demons, does he? He is the Son of God, but he doesn't want the demons to be the ones to announce him. Chapter 5, verse 7, also we have demons saying, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God?" The Father, again, in Mark chapter 9, says that, "This is my beloved Son, listen to him." This is on the Mount of Transfiguration. Mark 13. Mark 13, verse 32. "But of that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone." So now Jesus himself mentions that he is the Son. He calls himself the Son. Chapter 14. Jesus is at his trial now, one of his trials. Verse 61 and 62. But Jesus kept silent and did not answer. Again, the high priest was questioning him and saying to him, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus said, "I am. And you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven." Again, Jesus attesting to his own sonship as the Son of God. And remember, this is the charge for which he was crucified, right? The charge ultimately was blasphemy. To claim to be the Son of God was, for anyone else but Jesus, a blasphemy. And that is why he was crucified, at least from the perspective and the charge of the Jewish leadership. And then one last verse, Mark 15, verse 39, we have the claim of the centurion at the foot of the cross. When the centurion who was standing right in front of him saw the way he had breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God." So the testimony of the Father, even of demons, of Jesus himself, and of the centurion was that Jesus was the Son of God, plus his speaking and his miracles attested to his sonship. Another focus of Matthew, besides being Jesus being the Son of God, is that Jesus is a man as well. He's not just some sort of super angel or something like that, but he is really a man. And we see this in a number of ways. Let me just focus on one area in particular, and that is his emotions. Let me read to you Matthew 8, 2 and 3. "And a leper came to Jesus and bowed down before him and said, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean.' And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' And immediately his leprosy was cleansed." So there's a story from the Gospel of Matthew. Now Luke tells the same story. And he says, "While he was in one of the cities, behold, there was a man covered with leprosy. When he saw Jesus, he fell on his face and implored him, saying, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean.' And he stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, 'I am willing, be cleansed.' And immediately the leprosy left him." Now, let's look at Mark's parallel passage here. We see that Mark chapter 1, verses 40 and 41. And listen to how Mark just adds a little feature to this that's different from, or it adds to what Matthew and Luke say. "A leper came to Jesus, beseeching him and falling on his knees before him, and saying, 'If you are willing, you can make me clean.' And moved with compassion, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, 'I am willing, be cleansed.'" So Mark adds the detail that Jesus was moved with compassion. We see his emotion. He sees this leper and he's moved with compassion and he wants to heal him. Another situation sort of like this in Matthew 12, and I won't read this whole thing, but Jesus is talking about he wants to heal a man on a Sabbath in the synagogue, and the Pharisees don't want Jesus to heal. They think it's wrong to heal on the Sabbath. And so Jesus tells them, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? If you had a sheep, you would take care of your sheep on that day. And so Jesus says at the end of this passage, you can see on the screen there, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand," and he stretched it out. It was restored to normal like the other. Luke says basically the same thing. Jesus, after looking around at them all, said to him, "Stretch out your hand," and he did so, and his hand was restored. So we have those stories, but then we go to Mark chapter 3, verse 5, the same story. It says that Jesus looked around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart. And so Mark gives us an insight into the emotions of Jesus when this was happening. He saw the hypocrisy of these Pharisees, and it made him angry, it made him grieved at their hardness of heart. That's one detail that Mark puts in there that the other gospel writers don't. There's also a few beautiful small details that I really had to see as I was studying this. In Matthew chapter 18. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus and said, "Who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And he called a child to himself and set him before them. And Luke 9, another parallel passage, says in verses 46 and 47, "An argument started among them as to which of them might be the greatest. But Jesus, knowing what they were thinking in their heart, took a child and stood him by his side." And so we have this picture of Jesus wanting to illustrate what true greatness was, brought a child from the crowd and brought them to his side. But listen to what Mark says. Again, a really beautiful detail as to what Jesus was doing there. Mark 9, verse 36. It says here that taking a child, Jesus set them before him, and taking him in his arms, he said to them. And so we have in Matthew and Luke, Jesus sets the child before him. But then in Mark, after he sets the child before him, he takes the child into his arms and holds him. That's a kind of detail that would be sort of an eyewitness account, or at least a second-hand account of what had happened at that time. We see Jesus not just using a child as a prop, but this child was dear to Jesus, and Jesus took him in his arms as he gave this illustration. Something else happens like this in Mark chapter 10, verse 16. When, remember, families, parents would bring their children to Jesus to bless them, right? Well, Matthew and Luke mentioned that Jesus would touch the children as he blessed them. But Mark also has Jesus taking these children into his arms. So it wasn't just, you know, some people when they have children, you know, they just barely want to touch them. But Jesus would pick them up and he would hold them as he blessed them. It, again, showing an emotional aspect to Jesus that is not necessarily as fleshed out in other gospels. See how beautiful it is that God has given us these four gospels. Even when they tell the same story, sometimes you get a little bit of detail that you don't get in other gospels. It really rounds out our view of who Jesus is. Now let's move on to the overall theme. You see this often. If you study the Gospel of Mark, scholars will always say this, and this is true. Jesus is the servant. Remember in Matthew, Jesus is the king. In Mark, Jesus is a servant. He is a king as well, of course. He is the Messiah, but we see especially his servanthood. And you know this verse well. Mark 10:45 is often seen as the theme verse of the entire book. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. And this verse is at a pivot point in the gospel where we see Jesus ministering in Galilee, but now he's moving in this part of Mark to Jerusalem to be crucified. So we've seen his servanthood in his preaching and in his teaching in the early part of Mark. Now we see his servanthood in going to be a ransom for many. We also note that in Mark, there's no genealogy. Matthew and Luke have genealogies. John doesn't. But you would not expect a genealogy for a servant, as you might for a king. We also see in Mark that he focuses more on Jesus' deeds than on Jesus' words. If you happen to have a red-letter Bible, you can see this fairly easily. You go through Mark, you see not that very many long passages in Mark where Jesus is speaking a lot, but in Matthew and Luke, you see these long, long chapters. So Mark has fewer long speeches of Jesus than Matthew and Luke do. Again, focusing more on what Jesus did than what he said. Another feature of the Gospel of Mark I find interesting is that it's very fast-paced. When you look at the Gospel of Mark fairly closely, you see that he kind of packs a lot in there. First of all, Mark is by far the shortest gospel, so he has a lot of the same information as Matthew and Luke, but it's condensed, like the Reader's Digest condensed version of Jesus' life almost. We also notice if you look at the Greek, you don't even have to know Greek to find this interesting, but you can see yourself, more than half the verses begin with a little word, chi. Anybody know what chi means? Almost always? Yeah, Elijah. And, almost always and. It could be but. It's a conjunction, basically, but almost always translated and. And if you go to the Greek, every verse almost, or every other verse, will start and. Now, if you guys were writing in school, and every one of your sentences started with and, what would your teacher do? Check, yep, no good. Stylistically, in English, that's not a good thing, but for Mark, it was okay. He is just connecting things, and this. We also see that he uses a historical present more frequently than other gospel writers. Now, what is a historical present? Historical present basically means that you take a past tense, something that happened in the past, and you use the present tense to speak of it. We do this sometimes. Children especially will do this. They'll say, and then I says, and then he says, and then they says. They'll take what happened in the past and put it in the present. It kind of gives you a more heightened awareness of what's going on. That is, it's happening right now, like you're watching it on a movie screen, that kind of thing. And so when Mark is writing very often, more than the other gospel writers, and I won't go through these. Some of you, if you have a New American Standard, you can see this, in fact. If you see a verb in the gospels where there's a little asterisk next to it, that indicates that this is a historical present. So let me just give you one example. In Mark chapter 1, verse 12... Mark chapter 1, verse 12. It says, immediately the Spirit impelled him to go out into the wilderness. Now, in Greek, actually, it says, immediately the Spirit impels him. Impels. That's a present tense verb. but the English translators made it past tense because it's kind of confusing in English to keep going back to the present tense. Another interesting thing that keeps the gospel moving quickly, we see even in this verse of Mark chapter 1, verse 12, is this word immediately. We see this word immediately, it's a Greek word translated often immediately, used more than 40 times. And again, if you were writing a book like this in English and your teacher saw you use a particular word so many times, you would probably get marked down. But for Mark, it was okay because he wants to engage you with this idea that this stuff is happening kind of rapidly. In fact, one of the commentators say that this word immediately gives the gospel a certain air of breathlessness. That is, and then, it's like saying, and then, and then, and then. So look at verse 10 of Mark 1. Immediately coming out of the water, he saw the heavens opened. Verse 12, immediately the Spirit impelled him to go out of the wilderness. Verse 18, immediately they left their nets and followed him. Verse 20, immediately Jesus called them, and so forth. You see a lot of these things in this. In fact, in some kind of verses it says, and immediately. So we have these things sort of piling on each other as Mark is writing. And I really get the feeling, not to be disrespectful to Mark, but it sounds like children telling a story, right? Your children have something exciting they want to tell you. And then he did this, and I did this, and then they did this. It sounds like that kind of feeling where Mark just wants to bring us in there and grab us by the collar and get us through the story because it's so exciting to Mark, and he wants you to feel the urgency and the immediacy of what's going on in the life of Christ. Even some 30 years later, after Jesus was alive, for Mark, it was still present, and he wants you to feel that presence of Christ in this gospel, and it's almost exhausting. If you think immediately Jesus did this, you get the impression that Jesus is sort of racing around doing things, but Mark is just wanting to bring us along with him in this sort of high-speed, fast-paced gospel. Now, let me just tie up things fairly quickly here. I'm not going to go through the whole gospel and show what's happening, but I'll just give you an overview of the geography. Okay, you know this map, hopefully you can see it. I should have got the super high-res video projector, but it's not that great. Here is Judea and Jerusalem, of course, the center of Jewish life by the Dead Sea down here. We have Samaria. We'll learn about that another time. And here is Galilee. You can see this is pretty far away. I mean, if you wanted to drive there, it would be a very quick drive nowadays. But back in the day, it took a while to get from Galilee to Judea and vice versa. So people tended to kind of stay where they lived. And people who lived in Galilee who were Jewish, they would still have to go to Jerusalem for special festivals, things like that. But people didn't travel as much as we tend to today without having fast cars and trains and planes, that kind of thing. So here is the Sea of Galilee here. And this is where Jesus' ministry is mostly focused in Matthew and Mark and in Luke. In fact, if, as I said at an earlier time, if we only had Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you would get the impression that Jesus, while he was born near Jerusalem in Bethlehem, there's Bethlehem down here, but then he, after that, settled in Galilee and Nazareth and spent his time in Capernaum, Bethsaida, those sorts of places, that Jesus basically spent only time in Galilee, and then at the end of his life, he went to Jerusalem to be crucified. Now, we understand from the Gospel of John, and we know just from understanding the Jews of the time, as I said, they had to go to Jerusalem several times during the year for festivals. And so John mentions Jesus going to Jerusalem a number of times. But the way that Matthew, Mark, and Luke construct their Gospels, we see Jesus in Galilee for an unspecified period of time, ministering, preaching, healing, serving, and then he sets his face to go to Jerusalem, and he travels down here across the Jordan, ministers here for a while, crosses the Jordan, goes to Jerusalem, and then is crucified. That is the flow of the geography in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark. And we'll look at Luke next time. So we see early on in Mark chapter 1, Jesus in Galilee, it says, after John had been taken to custody, Jesus came to Galilee preaching the gospel of God. And then later in Mark 1, he's going throughout all Galilee preaching and casting out demons. In fact, in Mark 3, we see Jesus in Galilee, but people are coming from all over. So whereas in John you see Jesus going around to places, in Mark we see Jesus based in Galilee and people coming from all over to see Jesus. He's the latest big thing, and people come from way down in Judea and all over to see Jesus. We see Jesus in Galilee again in Mark 3, where scribes come from Jerusalem. So the Pharisees send a delegation to Jerusalem to see who is this man Jesus, while Jesus is up in Galilee. So they're going to Jesus. Jesus isn't coming to them necessarily. Then later in Mark 7, Jesus goes to Tyre. Remember? Tyre and Sidon's up here. Again, sorry, it's so fuzzy. But in Phoenicia, this is where he heals that the daughter of the Syrophoenician woman, the Canaanite woman who lives up here. So Jesus has some sort of retreat up here to Tyre and Sidon, this area up here. He also spent some time in Caesarea Philippi, which is around here. So that's some ways north of the Sea of Galilee. Remember when Jesus asked Peter, who do people say that I am? And Jesus says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. That happened up here in Caesarea Philippi. And then we see him in Mark 10, leaving Galilee, finally going on his way to Jerusalem. He makes his way from Galilee to Jerusalem. He begins to tell the disciples that he is going there to be crucified. He goes up to Jerusalem in Mark 10, and then he has, remember, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem in Mark 11. So he's hailed at this time as a king by the people, but that quickly falls away in just a matter of days. We see Mark, especially this writer of the servanthood of Christ, spends 6 of his 16 chapters on the last week of Jesus' life. So about 40% of the Gospel of Mark just focuses on the last week, the Passion Week of Jesus. And then at that point, when Jesus finally arrives in Jerusalem, the triumphal entry in the days before his crucifixion, we see Jesus going in and out of Jerusalem. So he's in Jerusalem, he goes over to Bethany, kind of back and forth, and he has interactions with the Pharisees. And it, as we said in the Gospel of Matthew, this sort of pressure cooker is happening. Already the Pharisees and Sadducees didn't like Jesus, but now that he's in Jerusalem, this conflict becomes even greater, and Jesus confronts them on their hypocrisy and their sinfulness, and their hatred gets stronger and stronger each day to the point where they can finally crucify him on the day of Passover. So that's the Gospel of Mark in about 45 minutes. Hopefully you've managed to follow along with me. It's really a beautiful little gospel. It's so short, it's nice because it's easy to digest in a small period of time. In fact, very often when translators want to translate a gospel to a new language, they'll start with Mark because you can get the story of Jesus down more quickly than you could, say, with Matthew or Luke or even John. But really, really a concentrated gospel, you might say. Any questions before we close? Yes, Brett. That's a big area of discussion. A lot of people do. For most of church history, people believe Matthew was written first, and Mark came later. It's basically since the 19th century, we have all these kinds of critical views of the Bible, where people say that Mark came first. I don't really know. I don't take a position on that. I haven't studied that thoroughly. In fact, it's not really that interesting to me. For me, if you want to study, that's fine. But there's lots of theories about how many sources were there. Did Mark and Matthew and Luke have another source? Were there two sources? Were there three sources? Were there lots of sources? Was Matthew originally written in Aramaic? And there's just so many things about this. Who borrows from whom? Does Matthew borrow from Mark? Does Luke borrow from Mark and Matthew? I don't know. There's lots of arguments around, but there's no one theory that really accounts for everything. There's enough ambiguity and difficulty in all this thing for me personally. Again, if you want to study it, that's fine. To say, you know what, I'm not a scholar of these things. I believe that it's God's word, and whoever relied on whoever doesn't ultimately matter because we know it's the truth from God. But it is interesting, and that's what we're going to do as we go through the life of Christ, is compare Matthew, Mark, and Luke, especially when we get these parallel passages. And it really is interesting, as we found with Jesus taking children into his arms in the Gospel of Mark, to see the subtle differences, not differences in the fact that they contradict each other, but just if you had different people telling the same story, they might give different details. And when you compare the details, you get a fuller picture of the life of Christ. Any other questions? All right, well, let's close in prayer. Dear Father, we rejoice as we look at this Gospel of Mark, even in a brief period of time. As we see Jesus in its pages, we see this God-man, this this man Jesus, who is also the anointed one, the Christ, who is also the Son of God. And our mind is amazed as we think about these truths and how wonderful they are, and we can't truly understand them more than just a little bit as our finite minds try to wrap their mind around infinity. Yeah, how beautiful is it to see this man who is God? We see the attributes of God. We also see the attributes of men. We see his anger, unbelief, as we should be angry at unbelief, and his grief, seeing hardened hearts, and his joy. We see his love of these little children. We see all these things in this man who loved us and who gave his life as a ransom for many. May we look at his life and be servants as he is a servant. May we not argue like the disciples did as to who is the greatest, but may we seek to serve each other, even as Jesus himself served us, to live sacrificial lives for the sake of your kingdom. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.